As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Hello, 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 everyone. Welcome to the Gravity... Yep.
Intro?
Intro to... This is... Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Cod...
Yes.
Codpast.
Yes.
I've been doing that a lot more lately. I don't know if it's a sign of cognitive decline, but I've been doing... I'm 44. But I did, you know, I mix up consonants. Codpast. That one kind of makes me chuckle.
Yeah.
Things like that. I do that a lot more than I used to. So I'm just sort of, you know, just embracing my own cognitive decline, apparently. But anyway.
it's nothing to joke about, dude.
No, I know. It's good to be with you again, friends, listeners. We so appreciate your participation in our community and your participation in these conversations.
You know, who's not cognitively declining?
Who's that?
Aside from any very stable geniuses you may know in real life, Amy Brown Hughes.
Oh, yeah. She's definitely not cognitively declining.
She may be on the cognitive incline. Like, yeah. She's just getting incredible.
Started. She's just getting started in her cognition.
Well,
this interview is great.
Yep. Yeah, she's written a book about Christian women in the patristic era.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
It's like a Baker academic book, so it's not like something that I think a lot of people would hear about or know about,
right.
Because it's, I don't know, sometimes pastors are just reading whatever's on the bestseller list or whatever. But this book and her writing in this book is compelling and fascinating. Mm-hmm. I had this picture, I'll just confess, I had this kind of rather pejorative, misogynistic picture of like the early church, like women were sort of not given any leadership or didn't have any authority or influence, or they didn't have really a voice. And of course that happened, right? But Amy's book tells the story of some amazing women, just amazing women, including the sister to Gregor of Nyssa, who he calls father. He calls his sister father for how she teaches him. Mm-hmm. And so the person who wrote, you know, the Nicene Creed was discipled by his sister, and she tells her story and other stories. I just think it's incredible. So I'm just excited we get to share this interview with you today.
Yes, it's good stuff. Enjoy it. I don't think we need to announce anything else. Just love that you're with us on this journey, friends. Thanks for being part of what we're doing.
I'd like to make a quick announcement.
Okay,
that's okay. I just want to say that I've went through my 44-year-old brain, and I can't with confidence endorse your diagnosis of cognitive decline. I think you're doing all right, Ben.
Oh, thanks.
Considering your circumstances.
Super encouraging to hear that despite my circumstances or considering them.
I'm still
doing all right.
Yeah. I mean, you're
all right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for making that announcement. I appreciate that. Friends, don't hesitate to reach out if you do have any, ideas for us, people that you think should be on the podcast, questions you have, podcast@gravityleadership.com. We will see you next time. Here we go.
Amy Brown Hughes, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
It is lovely to be here.
Yes. I just have to say, we interview a lot of people, and I think I can tell a lot about who they are. At least I tell myself I can tell a lot about who they are based upon what's behind them. And I'll just say, you're associate professor, right, of theology at Gordon
Assistant
College.
Assistant professor. Thank you for giving me a premature promotion.
Yeah, it's just going to get better. Today is just going to get better. Yeah. But like prominently displayed behind you, is the Harry Potter series.
Yeah.
Right on your bookshelf. Not only are the books beautiful, but I just started reading that again last night to my 11-year-old. Because we got to the third book when he was like 6 and he got super scared. So we stopped. And now I think
he did?
The Dementors scared him. You know, they're scary critters.
It gets dark. Yeah. It gets dark.
So anyway, I just want to acknowledge that.
I do have to say, I've told my students on multiple occasions, because I use Harry Potter as an example in eschatology, that I would love to teach like a theology of Harry Potter and couple other things. It's one of those someday.
That's really cool.
Beth Felker Jones at Wheaton has, she said before that Harry Potter is one of the best theologies of death going. So
I believe it.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a joke at our church. Matt and I co-pastor a church together. And there's a little bit of a joke that we in our preaching, we have a connecting story as kind of a story that people are generally familiar with, sometimes from a story or a book or a movie or sometimes from our life. But anyway, oftentimes my connecting stories end up being Harry Potter
stories.
It's about
68% of the time, yeah.
68% of the time, Harry Potter is like, this is because it's always perfect. I was like, this is perfect for the text.
Yes. Anyway. So you teach theology at Gordon College. You also host a podcast on Script, co-host it with a number of other people. It's one of my favorite like geek out podcasts. When I don't have $85 to buy some sort of book that I really want to know about, you guys will interview the author. But I just want to say, we had Matthew Bates on a few months ago, and I said this to him too. But that interview you did with John Baer from the Shota House, I think I've listened to it 3 times, Amy. And I know you were excited just by the tone of your voice as you talked to him. And I feel like you were channeling my excitement during that interview. So if you haven't listened to it, we'll put that link in the show notes for that. It was a riveting conversation. But today, what we want to chat about is a book you've written, you co-wrote, called Christian Women in the Patristic World. And you trace the stories of a number of women from like the second through fifth centuries and about how they were portrayed, their leadership, their authority, their legacy, etc. And so I guess my question is, why would a 21st century pastor or house dad or, children's director, why would we care about patristic women? What is it that drew you to this project, and what is it? Why does it matter for us?
Representation matters. Yeah. I mean, I think about how often we just talked about using Harry Potter as a reference, right? And how often we use examples from Scripture and just examples through our lives and examples of people in history, for illustrations, for things, for ways that we all need heroes and people to imitate and to understand and to see others who are that we can be like. I mean, Paul talks, says, right, imitate me. So there's a sense in which we need to be able to see what we want to be in someone else.
Yes.
And there are very few for women. I mean, growing up in the church, I remember it being really stunning. I was reading a book. I can't remember what it was. And I was reading the book and it really put in relief for me. It was a book on, I don't remember what it was, something on like mentoring leadership or something. This was like 20 years ago. And all of the examples that were used were men. Yes. And I just thought, and the author wasn't he wasn't making a statement on like women can't be in leadership. It just so happened that all of the leaders of the things he was giving examples of were all men. And I was like, wow. For me, I mean, this is a very personal book for me because I, even coming to be a theologian, that didn't occur to me until way late because I had never seen a woman theologian. And I'd seen women biblical scholars. The chair of the Department of Bible Admissions or whatever they're calling it now at ORU was a woman when I was there. But I never had a class until my graduate studies with a woman in theology. I'd never read a book by a woman who's a theologian. And so it didn't even occur to me that that was a possibility.
Yeah.
So representation matters because if you look back, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about the early church and why it was important. And if you don't think women participated in that and continued to participate in that, we sort of just assume, well, after the canon was closed that, you know, Christians kept doing stuff, but we hear about Augustine, we hear, we don't tend to hear about these others. So
yeah,
on
good.
The very basic level, that's what I would
say. So you're telling the stories of women who have been leaders and models for current women today, but also for guys to be like, oh yeah, this isn't just, there are women who have done this for centuries. Yeah.
Well, and the point is that you can't draw a real definitive line between the two. They work together. That's one of my favorite aspects of this is how they needed each other. They didn't have this dividing line between men did this kind of thing and women did this kind of thing. I mean, there was some cultural stuff like that, but Christianity had to deal with right off the bat that it was pretty clear that they were supposed to do things differently than they were used to in the Roman Empire. So they had to contend with that and to figure out what to do.
Yeah. One of the surprising things as I read this book, Amy, was the tension that, or maybe the language that surrounds women and women in authority or leadership today. We hear about local church pastors and we hear about, and then there's debates on whether or not women could be local church pastors. We hear words like headship and we hear words like, gender roles, things like that. But I'm struck by the fact that none of that really shows up at all in the early church. Like that wasn't the conversation. Those weren't the frames that people were using. And in a sense, like the words that kept coming out as I read were words like, what really stood out to me was martyrdom and like the paragon of virginity. And so I wonder, like, what was different in this early church about how people saw authority and gender, and what was valued different then than is valued today?
Yeah, really good question. There's kind of two parts to this question because we're all in a context, right? No matter when we live or where we are. And these early Christians were in the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire had very specific ideas about what women were and what they were for. And they were having their own conversation about this. So underlying some of this, we only address it very briefly in a couple of portions. But there was a whole lot of conversation about laws about marriage and such and who gets inheritances and all sorts of things during the few hundred years at the beginning of the Roman Empire. So there was this societal-wide conversation about women and what kind of power they could have with money, what kind of power they could have in their homes, because oftentimes women married younger in their like late teens, early 20s, like, 18 to 20 something.
Yeah.
And men were often older, so they would often die. And you had these women who had all of this money. And so there were very powerful women, who supported the arts and who supported a lot of things. And they were not super interested in all of that money being dispersed. And it wasn't necessarily best for society for that to be the case either. There's a really great book that goes into all of this. Peter Brown, the eminent historian, he wrote this book called The Eye of the Needle, Through the Eye of the Needle, and talks about like sort of shifting of money, because it was actually, that was where a lot of the power dynamics was really centered on. And in the church, so that was underlying all of it. So you have a lot of the women we talk about who are incredibly wealthy. And the reason they were incredibly wealthy was because some of these law changes. And so they were faced with the question of, what do I do with all this money? And as a Christian, because there's a sense in which they associated having all of this wealth and having all this luxury and having all this power with being aligned with the world. So a lot of the ways Christian women exercise their authority was in choosing not to participate in the society with all of their money and power, which is like opposite of what we do, is we tend to go like, get all the power and stick it in our ears and then I can change the system, right?
Yes, yeah.
But they, Melania, I think it was Melania the Younger specifically, who was beyond a wealth that we can possibly imagine right now. I mean, maybe Jeff Bezos, but who wants to compare anything to him? So Melania the Younger, sorry.
There's a safe space for you, Amy.
Yeah. So Melania the Younger, the Empress actually came to her and says, please don't like sell all your stuff, because if you do, our economy will collapse, basically. So Melania's like, oh, I understand. I'm still doing it. There's a sense of giving up the hairstyles, the clothes, all the way down to the food, which is where a lot of that ascetic
renunciation
stuff comes from, which for us can be very hard to understand. Why were they doing this? And it's because they associated all this stuff with the poisonous ways that society operated. And they were no, not going to do it. So in some of the ways, the women in this book giving up power gave them a different kind of power. But then you have later in the book, like the empresses, who in other ways, like Pulcheria, who basically ran the empire, right? And they're another kind of story, because as we talk about in the book, the idea of empress, like, what did that even mean?
Yes.
So they took the opportunities that were given to them to expand their own sense of leadership and their own sense of contribution. And pretty much every woman did that in some sense, whether it was the frame of martyrdom, whether it was the frame of I'm a wealthy woman giving up everything for asceticism.
Yes.
Whatever package they were given, women, including many that we didn't name in the book, used that opportunity to flourish and to become who they wanted to be and who they understood themselves to be in Christ, granted whatever they had, even if they had all these structures around them. And I feel like that is also eminently relatable, because there's a, you know, how many of us are in situations where in churches where, as you mentioned, where you might have some practical or theological things that maybe you want to be a pastor and you can't. or something like that. What does it look like to, and it's a constant negotiation, what does it look like to work within that structure and but at the same time not submit to that structure? What does it look like to, when do you leave a structure? Like all of those questions, I feel like these early women help to, they're like people that can come alongside us in those conversations.
Yeah.
Because I wish it has changed. I wish it has changed.
Yeah, they fill out our imagination for our own habit, unjust systems and structures, where maybe you don't get the Jeff Bezos power, but how do you operate in the Jeff Bezos world with authority and with power?
Yeah.
And you mentioned asceticism. I think the other two that come out in story after story is the honor or the dignity of virginity, and the honor and the dignity and the power of martyrdom. So martyrdom, virginity, and asceticism were sort of like these three themes that kept coming up over and over and over. And I can't think of something more unpalatable to a 21st century American than those right. three things, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how un-American dream is asceticism, virginity, and martyrdom? I would love it if you could just maybe speak to this virginity piece, because I've talking with a lot of people in my generation, you know, I'm 43, sort of the Josh Harris generation, who grew up in the purity culture and worked for some people, for many people, they're sort of deconstructing that and healing from that. But the early church doesn't have this baggage, it doesn't seem. They may have different baggage, but I wonder if you could help us understand, how is a purity or virginity, how did that function differently in the Roman Empire than maybe it does in some of our Christian subcultures?
So this is an area where Christians were innovators, significant innovators. So the whole story of virginity would take me hours to explain. So I'll sum up.
That's good.
Too much time. I'll sum up. Virginity doesn't mean to them what we assume it means now. So when we talk about virginity now, it's abstinence, it's not having sex and such. And that was part of it. But virginity for the early Christians, they understood it as a theological category that was Christological in shape, that virginity was basically the glue that held all of the other virtues together. So they understood virginity in the sense of chastity, where it included the idea of modesty, which was a value in the Roman Empire for women, but it took that idea of modesty and it sort of flipped it on its head and gave it a sense of agency for a different kind of agency for the woman than was offered. Because in the Roman Empire, the idea of women virgins was sort of this sense of like Lucretia, for instance, where she wasn't a virgin, she was married, but because she was raped by someone, right? Like she instead, you know, killed herself, and that was deemed a great honor. And Christians were like, I don't think so. So virginity became this place where you could imitate Christ. And it really quickly became a place where women specifically, although there were a lot of men who did this too, Gregory of Nyssa wrote a theological treatise on virginity that was actually directed at men. And there is some distinction in how the West and East approach this. So I'll speak to the Eastern Christians specifically, because I think that they have a sort of very fully orbed understanding of virginity as a place of exercising virtue.
Yes.
So it was both. You became a virgin, which was like an office in the church. You became a virgin because it's not because you were holier than thou or because you were wearing some sort of ring and saying, look at me, I'm pure. It was because you recognized that you were weak and you wanted to serve Christ your entire life and you wanted to imitate Christ. And you had two choices as a woman in Roman society. You were married or you were not yet married.
Yes.
Right.
So virginity was agency. And it was associated also with widows. Like there's a lot of conversation about widows because uh-huh. there was a lot of widows in the Roman Empire. But widows could also fell into this category, especially early on, and could become like consecrated virgins, even though they weren't always virgins, but they could be a part of that for the rest of their lives. So it was a place of, it was another example of women who are seeing an opportunity and kind of making it a thing, because very quickly the early church figured out that they had to hierarchize the church in order to have structure. And women, while they were very active, found their roles getting more and more constricted. And the office of virgin, if I can call it that, became a space where they could control that environment, which is why you have all these women that we talk about in the book who had convents in their homes. That they would create these spaces where Jerome would come to Marcella. Because she wasn't at a church. She wasn't, you know, she didn't have an office somewhere. Like that was her home. She had set up a space. Pulcheria does the same thing as Empress. And they all do this. And it becomes a space where they have a sense of power that, but they understand themselves as living into, like, living a Christ-shaped life.
Yes.
And Christ being the one who holds all virtues together. This becomes a place where they freely choose this role, which, as a side benefit for some, included not having to get married to somebody you didn't want to get married to.
Who was 20 years older than you and a creep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and you mentioned martyrdom, and I'll just quickly say this, because I think we use the term martyr, like we throw it around all over the place. And I'm, especially in Christianity, I'm deeply concerned about that. Martyrdom in the early church was a very specific thing. And the early church had to figure out they had to discuss and figure out what actually categorized a martyr, because you couldn't, it couldn't be suicide. and it also couldn't be, like, it had to be an imitation of Christ in submitting to an evil, unjust system, but yet holding on to who Christ was and not letting that go. And I think the ways that sometimes, that's how Christians understood it. Of course, you can have martyrs from other sort of structures, but asceticism became the way that Christians held on to the witness of the martyrs, because when they weren't being persecuted anymore in the same way they were prior to Constantine, asceticism became a way to hold on to that tradition and to do what Paul says, like, by dying daily and imitating Christ. So that's the connection between those two things. And I understand that those things are not how we value the world, but I would say that maybe we could do with a little bit more understanding that we can embody the virtues.
Yeah,
right.
And that those things actually feed into our Christianity, and we can be more like the more we imitate Christ, the more we embody the virtue of humility, the more we embody the virtue of chastity and patience and all these different things. So it might not be the same structure that they had, but I think that we can get really sort of obsessed with the packaging.
Yeah.
They were more interested in the telos, in where it was going.
Yes.
Who they were becoming.
Yes.
Who they were transforming into. And this was the way that they saw, this was an avenue for doing that. So what are our avenues today? Would be my question.
Yeah. It's a great question. Ben, what are you noticing?
Yeah, I guess I'm just noticing a lot of, this is really helpful. I think, because, like you said at the beginning, Amy, the representation matters, right? But it also matters, like, that representation matters because it's important to know what these women were doing when they were doing what they were doing. You know what I mean? Like, what the telos is here. They weren't just sort of meekly sort of submitting to some expectation that culture had put on them that you're supposed to do this and this and this. This was actually their way of grabbing agency and sort of inhabiting their authority in Christ and saying, I'm actually going to, you know, despite what culture says about who I can and can't be and what I can and can't do, I'm going to take authority in my body by embracing these practices so that I become a certain kind of person. And there's a real power in that, because their witness is that the empire can't take that away. You know, the worst the empire can do is kill you, which actually helps me. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of their attitude towards it. So,
One of my favorite stories that exemplifies this is very early on, where Eusebius, in his church history, includes the story of Blandina, the slave girl who was among the martyrs in the martyrs of Lyon and Vienne very early. In the second century, and her having several strikes against her, being a slave and a girl, a young woman, she's basically a flea, and had no personhood.
Yeah.
And yet there she was, at every turn, the soldiers couldn't kill her. And then she, when they hung her up on a pole, she was in the shape of a cross. And the text says that everyone looked upon her and saw her as Christ, which is a very important distinction. Like, they still saw Blandina.
Yes.
But they saw her as Christ, and she became a witness in that moment. And what a stunning thing, because I don't think this should be an excuse. Like, we shouldn't be like, oh, it's we're good to keep the unjust system around so that we can have martyrs. Of course, we don't want to do that. The idea would be that we not have that at all. And and even with this virginity piece, I mentioned I focus on the East, because in the West, well, both sides, but really in the West, there becomes a real constricting of how virgins could operate,
and
what they could look like, and what they could dress. And it became a space where that agency wasn't allowed to flourish as it could have. So it wasn't just like the Christians versus the empire. The women were also contending with how their agency was being limited or cultivated within the church.
Within the church, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's really good that we've sorted that out and that doesn't happen anymore. So that's really good.
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
All right, I have a few more questions, but first, something you do on your podcast, and I want to pay homage to this, is we want to do a speed round. Some quick fire questions that you, Amy, you haven't heard these before. Just give us your blink, your 5-second blink. This first one isn't fair, but I'm going to do it anyway. Were there women priests in some early churches?
Probably.
If you weren't an assistant professor, what would you be doing?
Oh, man. Trying to be an assistant professor.
Favorite book that you've read in the last 5 years?
Oh, any kind of book? Like
any, kind of book.
Oh, gosh. I can't even think of the books I've read recently. You know, I really enjoy, like, fiction-wise, I really enjoy Pierce Brown's series, his, like, Red Rising series. Where it's like it's the Roman Empire in space.
Oh, wow. All right. I'm writing that down. Okay. Yeah. Something people would be surprised to find out about you, as somebody who's written a book about a patristic woman.
Something that's surprised about me. Well, I think something we mentioned early on before we hit record is that I used to teach improv.
Yes, that was surprising.
I was surprised.
That I originally wanted to be an English teacher.
Oh, okay, cool. Church fathers or modern scholarship? You have to pick one. Which do you read?
Probably church fathers, unless you're talking about somebody like Sarah Coakley or James Cone.
Oh, gosh. We may be connected on a deep subterranean level here. This is great. Sweet or savory?
Sweet.
Quarantine or Rumspringa?
Well, I'm a bit of a hermit. I actually chose the office at Gordon. They gave me a choice of window office or the one that was in the dark, and I chose the one in the dark. So I think I'm gonna go with quarantine.
That's great. Thanks for doing that. I want to return to this first question I asked you in the speed round about women priests. You know, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I read an article that came out after your book about a new painting or fresco that had been revealed in Rome that seemed to show, some people think it's the mother of Jesus, Mary, as a priest.
Blessing the Eucharist and, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is, so this is a big topic in our neck of the woods. I mean, we're in a denomination that has some churches that ordain women, some that don't. And all of them, the people that don't tie it to the early church, right? That we've never ordained priests as women, et cetera, et cetera. Like, what have you discovered about the plural? I think there's some diversity here, and I'd love it if What have you discovered about that? What have you learned about that?
So I think it's really interesting, first of all, that any denomination would use this as a factor. Okay. Maybe I'll set that off to the side.
Yes, it is confusing. It's confusing to us as well.
Yeah, it's like taking a random passage of scripture and saying, yeah, it's like proof texting history. So, okay, I think one thing's important is our idea of priest versus what we're talking about in the early church, because I think we tend to map mm-hmm. our idea of priest onto the early church. And so it's like asking the question of whether Phoebe or these other women who led churches in the New Testament, were they priests? Like, it's like that. It's almost like a categorical error. Like, well, they had a house, like they ran a church in their home. So they preached and they did all these things. Would you call them a priest? Well, they surely had the Lord's Supper and the Eucharist in their home, whatever that looked like at the time. So I think there's a contextual error here. So having frescoes of women presiding over the Eucharist, I mean, there was some debate about this in the early church, right? Because there was the new prophecy, also known as the Montanus, that drove some people crazy because a couple of the women who were the prophetesses, they were doing some women were baptizing.
Oh, okay.
And this was really troubling to some people. And they were sort of later declared as heretics, but at the same time, the church was kind of up in the air about what to do with them. So yeah. This was a division at the time as well. And I think it's really hard to say that women weren't performing all of this stuff, because they were, but the debate was very similar then as well. So yeah. To say that there weren't or there were is like, of course there were. Now, whether it was embraced as sort of general church practice, no, because misogyny has always been around. So it depended on the region and, you know, so.
Yes.
Like the fresco that has a woman there, I'm like, well, yeah, sure. But it almost matters what the church, what pathway the church ended up choosing into. They chose against this.
Right.
And that, to me, I don't think it's not, we have to look at this and go, okay, why did that happen? I'm more interested in, like, if we get stuck in the origins question, it's almost like we avoid the question that is the actual one we should be asking, is why did they choose the way that they did? And obviously that was a problematic choice from my perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. What would you say? Why? What's the 60 second on why they chose the way they did? You mentioned misogyny.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that they chose the way they did largely because what do you do when you have a fledgling organization that's spread all over the place and you have to have some consistency? You have churches who are baptizing in the name of Jesus. You have churches who are saying that the Holy Spirit's not fully God. You have all this stuff everywhere. So it wasn't just about women. It was also about all the things. How do we have a church? They were passing around the Didache. They were trying to say, okay, this is how you embrace a prophet. This is how you not, like, because churches were all over the place doing all sorts of things. They were passing around different letters and some were reading Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and the others weren't. And so they were they had to have some kind of organizational structure. So Cyprian is a good example of this, of Carthage, where he is one of the early church people who were like, okay, we need to establish some structure. And what do? You look at what you got and then go, okay, what around me helps me to understand structure? It's like what we're doing today as a church, where we look at successful businesses and then we model our churches after that.
We have
boards of trustees instead of elders.
Yes.
Same idea. They looked at the Roman Empire and women had no place in the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
In their structure, in their leadership structure. So you look at what you know, and then you modify it in a way that you think works, and then you should try to do that. So the church was always, this never quite fit, but it's what they had.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's good. That's good. Maybe diving into one small story here before we close. I had heard about Macrina. You know, the older sister of Gregory, but I had never read her story until I read your book. And she's my favorite. Like, she is such a baller. You entitle the chapter Macrina the Ascetic Entrepreneur. Maybe just to give a flavor a bit of your book, because there's so many amazing stories in this book. Could you just tell us a little bit about her story?
Yeah, so Macrina was one of the second oldest of a large family in Cappadocia, which is now modern day Turkey. And their father died so they had a mom that was running the family, and she, Amelia, her mom, was very upset about, you know, just the loss of her husband and everything. And so Macrina pretty early on emerged as a leader in the family because of grief, because for whatever reason, Amelia struggled in some ways and needed help. And so Macrina took over in a lot of ways, running the household, and not just running the household, like because they were a wealthy family. So they had a lot of land, they had, slaves, they had all sorts of people that were part of this, structure of an estate. And Amelia took over that aspect of it. She also took over the schooling aspect of it, and tutored her brothers and really became sort of the center point of this family. And as she grew, she chose into becoming a person who was an ascetic. But at the time, there was not a whole lot of models for what that looked like. So she kind of transformed their home into this sort of place and emancipated all the slaves in the house, which not something others did. So you'll find actually the most full-throated defense of how slavery is an evil actually comes from Gregory of Nyssa. And it has
her brother.
And how basically Christians shouldn't own people. Basic, but this is where you get this, and it's because their family was part. She was the core of how this family lived into what it meant to be, to be Christian in so many ways. And she set up this whole structure in their home where other women joined the slaves could be a part of it. She baked bread. She did all the things a Roman matron probably shouldn't do. She also got out of being engaged to a guy by saying, "Well, I'm engaged to Jesus." So we think you did that first, but actually she did. And then her Gregory of Nyssa wrote about her life, and in the life of Macrina, it's widely available on the internet. You can go read it. And then the companion piece of On the Soul and the Resurrection, which there were lots of on the souls, that it was a philosophical structure of a piece that, you know, Plato wrote one, lots of people wrote them. And he wrote one and cast Macrina as Socrates and himself as the questioner who didn't understand anything and asked her questions. And so it really demonstrates who he saw her to be in his life. And the life of Macrina is one of the most touching, beautiful homages to a sibling you could ever read. And I think that her diving into study, her diving into mentoring women, her diving into challenging her brothers and no holds barred saying, you know, telling her brother Basil that, you know, "Hey bro, you've got some power here. What's your problem?"
Yeah.
You know,
he didn't want to be bishop, and she was like, "Do it." Right. Wasn't that the story? Step up to the plate, buddy.
Yeah. And there was she was just, and we know her through Gregory. So obviously Macrina didn't write anything herself, but it's one of the pieces that we look at and go, why would Gregory have written something if it wasn't somehow based in reality in this way? And so we see her through Gregory's eyes, but in a lot of ways, I think that that's more telling than if she had written it herself.
Yes.
About how others did her.
Yeah. So, you know, the Cappadocian fathers are often referred to as like the fathers of Orthodoxy, right? Because of their role in the creeds. And it feels like she's the mother to the fathers of Orthodoxy. Like, you know, just as the same way Mary is the apostle to the apostles. And there's a sense in which it was striking to me that she was kind of like the Socrates meets Jesus meets like, William Wallace kind of figure. You know what I mean? Like, she was, and even Gregory referred to her as father, which was striking to me that he had no qualms with calling a woman father because of the role that she played in his life. Yeah, just powerful.
Yeah, she's quite something. And I think that her story, I'd like, one of the things I'd like to work on in the future is a book that is dedicated to her, talking about her and her story, more specifically. There's some stuff out there, but I'd like to spend more time with her.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Maybe as we close, is that what you're working on now, or do you have other things that you're spending time doing?
No, I'm well, sort of. I have some work for my dissertation that I'm trying to get into a book, but you know, worldwide pandemic has thrown some of that into disarray. I'm also doing some new research, and I'm very fascinated. On the Soul and the Resurrection is a good example of a dialogue in early Christianity. I find it very fascinating that early Christians used philosophical dialogue, as a way to do theology. And there's been a lot of books written on dialogue and how Christians used it and how philosophers used it. But I haven't really found much just looking at these dialogues for them as theological method. And I'm used to, like, if I ask my students, what is theology? You know, they'll point to a book on my shelf and go, you know, what they mean is a big book that a dude wrote, you know? and that's not... Because it's always a dude. And so that to me isn't theology. Theology is what happens in between.
Yes.
Christians. It's the church constantly in dynamic. And it's not just conversation. We're not just having chats. Like, dialogue, I understood it. It was supposed to go somewhere.
Yeah.
The idea was to understand what courage was by the end of the dialogue. Yes. And I think it's the same is true with these Christians. Like, these spaces where they come together in order to understand something, to me is the church is, you know, being the church with the Holy Spirit, coming to understand something of who God is. And so I'm beginning some work on, I've done some articles and presentations and such on this, but I want to do a book on that. So yeah,
that sounds great. That sounds fantastic. Yeah. I mean, we hear from people, I'm sure you hear from people too, who listen to your dialogues on your podcast, and it's actually, they're benefiting more than if they just read a straight didactic sort of presentation.
Well, and I base this a lot off of, in graduate school, one of the things we did, which was really wonderful, we started this while I was there, which we had these symposiums where we'd bring in probably 10 to 12 scholars on a topic, and they'd all bring papers, but most of it was them just talking between themselves on topics, like after the papers. So it wasn't just, you have 10 minutes for questions, like at an academic conference. It was like you presented a paper and then it was an hour to talk about it.
Yeah.
And as a graduate student, there was several of us graduate students who would just sit in the room and listen. And we often talked about how awesome it was to see our professors talking to each other. We're talking to other professors and how much we learned by that. And I thought, yeah, why don't we do that?
Yes. Right.
That seems relatively obvious. And also I think that it helps us not be in an echo chamber.
Yeah.
Where, because I know a lot of people will read all of one pastor's books, right? And they think they're learning about theology. And that pastor might have a lot to say that is really wonderful, but maybe there's someone who has a really strong critique to that pastor that you should also be listening to at the same time.
Yeah,
right. But we can't, because we're not listening to it as a conversation, we aren't necessarily getting the benefits from that. So I'd like to open a dialogue about how we might actually structure our theological exploration differently.
Yeah.
There are ways that I actually do this in my classes to anticipate some of that. So I've been doing pedagogy in thinking about how it might actually look in practice.
Yeah, the ancients may have something to teach us about pedagogy.
I talked to, I was at a conference last year and talking to Warren Smith from Duke, and he and I have a lot of, he loves Macarena too, and Gregory. And I was telling him about some of my work with Dialog, cause I did a paper there and we were talking about it. And he said, you know, I actually presented to an academic journal once if they, you know, that I wanted to do a theological dialogue, and they turned me down. Because we just don't do this, and that's not a structure we use anymore. But early Christians did it all the time.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. Well, I actually think the medium of podcasts is bringing back some of that. And so I appreciate you being on our podcast today, sharing all your research, your wealth of knowledge, and just your effervescent personality with us. It's just wonderful to be with you. How can people connect with you if they want to out in the wide world of the virtuals?
Well, I'm on Twitter. So you can come find me, Amy Brown Hughes, on Twitter. Okay. There's a lot of theologians on Twitter. We always have fun. Mm-hmm. And also Unscript, of course.
Yes.
Those are the places where you can find me. I'm not a blogger. That gives me hives to like think I have to write all the time.
That's why we started this podcast, because I was tired of writing. Amy, thanks for being with us today. Happy quarantine, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
It was a pleasure being with y'all.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebby, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online, as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.